to the Sound Effect Podcast, the podcast about sound effects. My name is Asbjørn Andersen, and I'm the founder of asoundeffect.com.
Hey, this is Jennifer Walden. I'm here with Mattia Cellato, sound designer and recordist, known for his sound libraries like the Animal Hyperrealism volumes, Metamorphosis, Polarity, Ultrasonic Dry Ice, and more. We'll be talking about his newest library, Cataclysm, a collection of explosions, falling trees, rock smashes, cannon blasts, and other destruction sounds. Plus, Cataclysm comes with synthesized elements like interesting reflections, impacts, passbys, and more. And there are ready-to-use designed elements of large-scale destruction. We'll be talking about Mattia's field recording adventures from the Carrara Marble Caves to the mountainous Italian Alps and places closer to home. We discuss his mics and mic placement, his approach to using plugins and processing, and other aspects of his creative process. Hey, Mattia, it's so nice to talk to you again. How are you?
Hello, I'm good. Thank you. And you?
I'm doing well, and I'm definitely excited to talk about Cataclysm. Let's take a listen to the preview so everyone can hear what this library is all about. So what was your inspiration for making Cataclysm?
That's a good question. As usual, I have approached the making of this library like I have approached most of the making of my past libraries, which is a bit of a loose getting the feel for something, getting into it more and more, and then shaping it into something that I thought made sense. For this library, there were a lot of inspirations from sound libraries. For example, I can talk about Frank Bree's Gun Tales, which have very interesting pinging reflections of environments that seem completely uncontaminated, and the signal-to-noise ratio is really good. Then there's also libraries like Boom Urban Explosions for the tightness of these kind of impacts. At the same time, I guess Dune and Star Wars have had a pretty big effect on me with regards to making this library, because both, let's say, franchises, they take sounds out of context, but they don't go overboard when it comes to designing, tweaking, or doing really crazy stuff to source a sound. So the idea is always to have source that is recorded in sort of either exotic ways or exotic contexts, or is recorded in sort of a standard way, so to say, but it is content that can be ultimately applied to other things in such a way that it can be listened to from a different perspective. And finally, games, I'm thinking maybe God of War or Battlefield, maybe God of War when it comes to like the fantasy of it and the anger that seems to be behind a lot of the sounds in that game, or in that franchise at least. And the Battlefield when it comes to, again, I feel when I'm talking about dynamic range or the tightness of the sounds, that has always been an inspiration for me, but especially when it comes to working with anything remotely close to explosions, I feel like I always need to go back to that to get inspired. So this mixture of media contributed to the idea as it developed into the library as it is now.
So you heard all of these inspiring sources for sounds and decided that you wanted to go out and blow things up and record them?
For some of it, yeah. I don't think this started as a library that I wanted to only have containing explosions. It started as me wanting to get familiar with the idea of recording higher caliber fire powder, let's say, or at least something bigger than standard weapons, so to say. And I wanted to do that just to feel a little bit more comfortable when it comes to understanding when a mic will hit, you know, analog clipping, since now we're moving to 32-bit recording. And I wanted to take advantage of that to understand, okay, if I'm clear on the digital side, then how can I use the microphones that I currently have to hit that sweet spot of sort of distorting, but not quite at an analog level? And what does it mean when it comes to trying and boost up tails without having to rely on something like a built-in limiter and instead doing it all in post? So I've started recording a few Canons that way, just to understand how I could have a personal spin-off on that kind of sound. And then this took me back to, again, libraries like Gun Tails, where the environmental reflections of the sounds really have a main role in the assets. And then I started thinking, oh, how could I do that, since at the moment I'm located in Sweden, but coming from Italy, I thought that maybe going back to the Alps to record some of these explosions or some of these transients would give me good signal-to-noise ratio. So that was a whole rabbit hole. Then there's the microphone's choice, and how could I make the image as wide as possible? How about pairing two 8070s and kind of splitting them apart in a super wide ORTF kind of fashion? So again, it all kind of snowballed very quickly, and then it kind of went back to, but it cannot just be about explosions. So I've recorded rock smashes, I've recorded ground pounders, trees falling, and other elements that I thought could contribute to the library. Sometimes they're big things like those, and other times they're things like a vase holder made of metal, simply recorded so hyper-realistically that you could think it's, you know, 5 or 10 times bigger than what it is. Or a vacuum cleaner suction kind of rattling against wood. Again, super close mic'd and super processed to sound very strange. So yeah, there's a whole bunch of things in there that I thought somehow fit the same collection. And it created this fairly varied selection of sounds, I'd say.
So Dune and Star Wars, I mean, those are typically thought of as like sci-fi or fantasy films. How did those influence your approach to Cataclysm?
Yeah, so when it comes to trying and working with a science fiction, but mostly fantasy theme in mind, this was about thinking of the application for the recordings and the parts that were synthesized and ultimately designed for the library, and keeping that kind of theme in mind as I edited the content. So for example, for the explosions, I wanted these mega tails, these mega reflections on the explosions, because I thought if you manage to fade in the attack, or at least remove enough of the initial transient to only have this blooming of the explosion and then the late reflections and so on and so forth, then this could be used in the context of, for example, the Force. Or if one, for example, tweaked enough something like the metal vase holder that I was talking about earlier, maybe it would feel like something in the lines of the thumper in Dune. It's mostly about the idea of keeping the assets rich and very defined from a dynamic standpoint. And when I say rich, of course, I mean it from a frequency standpoint, but without them revealing themselves at the point that can only be used for one thing and one thing only, if that makes sense. A good example of content that I recorded with this type of intention was the Forge Burner that I recorded for the library, along with a super hot metal, or better, iron ball that was heated up with this Forge Burner and then released or dropped on ice. And that generated a lot of kind of screeching sounds that maybe you could associate to something like, you know, a lightsaber fashion kind of weapon screeching against something else. So,
well, since you kindly shared that sound with us for the podcast, let's take a listen to some examples.
A lot of the content for the library, I wanted to have that kind of energy, that kind of violence. But at the same time, I wanted to keep it very open-ended when it comes to the application, if that makes sense. Then for the design section, I went a little bit more in the direction that I originally envisioned for the library. So something a little bit more fantasy, a little bit less realistic, where the tales become a little bit more blurred and it's about the power of them rather than being able to understand in which type of environment you are.
It sounds like the scope of this project was really big. So how long did it take you to gather all of these sounds, including like what it took to prep for each of these recording sessions, and then also to create the sounds for the designed sections?
Yes, this one was a long one. It took about 3 years. But then again, I work on these part-time. I've recently become a dad, so that also has affected the balance, of course, and how much time I put into making libraries on a daily basis. And finally, at the beginning of all of this, I was still finishing the latest animal library. So I kind of started recording some of those canons that I was talking about, moved back to finishing the animal library, gave myself a break, and then resumed working on these. When it comes to what took the most time, of course, it was the cleanup slash editing for the recorded section. But I would say that organizing these sessions was the toughest part by far. Mostly because we're talking about bringing explosives in areas like the Italian Alps. So acquiring permits for that type of feat is very, very hard. And it involves not only location managers, but insurances and pyrotechnic companies, and making sure that all of these work together in such a way that there's no surprises. You know, you never want to get to a location and realize, oh, we forgot to ask whether this thing could be turned off because it's making a hell of a noise, or whether the explosive could be fired at this distance from this building, which has glass doors or whatever else, you know, you name it. So that took a long, long time. The longest time it took to organize a session, I think it was 6 months. Just, I think, 3 months of attempts to get the location, and then 2 months of kind of scrambling to find a pyrotechnic company that would be willing to go to that location. And then 1 month of ultimately still sinking for the finer details of what to have explode where. There was a long, long effort for these, but it definitely paid off, I'd say. Most of this was also done remotely from Sweden to ultimately be conducted in Italy. So there was a layer of complexity that hopefully if someone stayed local, they wouldn't have to deal with. But of course, Sweden, at least the part that is accessible to me, is a lot flatter than Italy. Also, I wanted to go at high altitudes to ensure that the signal to noise ratio would be as good as possible. And I wanted to go to places that I have already visited, because in my head, I knew how they could potentially sound if a loud transient took place in those areas, despite not having had the pleasure before, if that makes sense.
So what were some of the locations that you visited, and why were these good locations for capturing the sounds of explosions and destruction?
Yeah, great question. So the majority of the recordings that I have made were done in Italy. So I already mentioned the Alps. There were a couple of sessions, and we're talking about the border with Switzerland, a couple of sessions that were done in a dam or close to a dam, where you have that kind of strange arch of concrete that the dam is, and then around that mountain range. So that was a very interesting recording session because of these scattered reflection that created a bit of a throbbing kind of a sound. It sounded like a motorbike kind of thing.
You shared a great example of that with us. So here is one of your explosion sounds at the dam.
I had another session at the top of mountain where a cable car brought you to. And again, that was interesting in its own way because we had both pyrotechnics there, and I brought my propane cannon, which I used for that session for the first time. And I had to travel with the propane cannon and a gas tank via the cable car, which was really not fun for someone that is afraid of heights like me. And I thought, okay, well, I mean, this is having the gas tank there if you've ever seen any movie.
Yeah.
You know? Now, of course, it doesn't necessarily happen in real life, but it just felt like, you know, I was asking for something bad to happen.
Right. I guess nothing bad happened and the trip must have turned out really well. Plus, you captured some amazing recordings. And here's actually one of those examples of the explosions that you recorded in the Alps.
Maybe the most memorable location that I went to, though, was the Carrara Marble Caves, which is this area where white marble is extracted. Michelangelo's David was made with that kind of marble, so it's a very visually striking location. It has these very geometrical cuts in the mountains, so the mountains look almost like, I want to say, kind of, you know, sliced cheese. But if you imagine a mountain with this kind of like very vertical type of cut. So some of the mountains would have these very geometrical shapes.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the surrounding mountains would be left more or less intact because, of course, the whole area has been excavated over the years. So you have these kind of scattered points of excavation where the marble is highly, highly reflective. So it almost sounds like an indoor space, even though it's an exterior space. But then, of course, if you had some microphones pointing out to other mountains, you could catch those late reflections in a lot more of a distinct way. So that was really, really interesting.
Well, let's take a listen to one of the recordings that you captured at the Carrara Marble Caves.
And then I must mention the contributions from Robbie Elias and Kyle Fraser, who did some recordings in Washington in a number of areas, from canyons to lakes surrounded by forests to rolling hills. And they did an amazing job both capturing the audio and documenting with video, as hopefully people will see with the extended trailer.
Yeah, in the trailer for the library, the places you visited looked amazing. I mean, just visually stunning. I can see why you chose these places for sound as well. There are so many surfaces at different distances for the sound to reflect off of. I had spoken to Richard King about the sound of Oppenheimer and, of course, the sound he created for the Trinity test. And in that interview, he said that explosions are hard to record, and much of what makes a good explosion recording is the location that it was recorded in, like canyons and enclosed valleys that will contain the sound. You know, otherwise, the sound just dissipates very quickly and it's just a big boom. So just from the Cataclysm trailer, it seems that you definitely understand and subscribe to the same theory as Richard King.
Yeah, definitely. I think it was about 7 or 8 years ago, I saw this video of someone blowing up, you could call them fireworks, but I guess they are high caliber explosives at that point, sort of handmade explosives in an area that I assume would be, it's definitely not Italy, but I think it's maybe in Czech Republic or Poland, in an area that, again, seems like mountains in the Alps fashion. In that video, even though the recording was quite poor from a sound perspective, you could hear how long tails you would get recording in that kind of an area.
Yeah.
And at that same time, I think for the company that I was working for, I was doing some explosive recordings and we were mostly conducting them in quarries. And we would constantly find ourselves trying to dig something out of the recording in post, something that wasn't necessarily there. So just kind of taking one of the mics and slowing down the take by like 50% or whatever, and then trying to figure out, can we extend the tail so that it feels like it was a little bit more consequential, so to speak. It's a word that I keep using for this library, but you know, the idea of that initial transient actually propagated longer, hit things that were further away,
yeah,
and lasted a little bit longer. And, you know, in that case, I ended up faking quite a bit of what I was trying to achieve for the sake of getting the final assets. And with this library, I went back to that idea of let's just go to the top of a mountain and let's blow things up, but if possible, if it's safe and if it's legal and everything. Yeah. And, you know, turns out that, for example, in places like Czech Republic or Poland, it's pretty much impossible to record in that kind of area because they will most likely be natural reserves, protected and not to be disturbed. Whereas in Italy, the majority of places is like that as well. But there can be scenarios where that kind of thing is allowed. For example, one of the first contacts that I made was this pyrotechnics company that managed to organize a fireworks night at the top of a mountain where, you know, this would be an event. So the fireworks would go off to music. There would be a bit more of an audience for this to be justified. Yeah. And I think it would happen towards the end of the year. I happened to be traveling to Italy towards the end of the year, the next year. And so I thought, would it be possible to organize this exact event at this exact location, but with one person in the audience, and that's me. I don't know how much you normally get paid, so let's start that conversation. And then they would get back to me and say, well, this is how it would normally work for us, you know. And so a lot of this was about really trying to make sure that I would be able to get these locations, because without the location, there's just no library. Even the cover of the library has these mountains in the background and kind of like a meteor hitting them or something coming out of black hole hitting them. And funnily enough, when this concept for the library was being made, I kind of forced myself to want it in the cover, even though I had yet to record that content. So I was so committed to the idea of making this happen that I wanted it to be in the cover of the library. And similarly, also the rock smashes and you know, draggings of rocks were one of the last things that I recorded for the library, just because I needed to have everything in place for it to feel exactly like what I envisioned in my head at the beginning. So I wanted the image to keep reminding me that I wanted to do certain things. So these locations are amazing, very hard to access though. Yeah, like I said, a bit of a nightmare with regards to organizing this, but it worked out.
So having that experience of trying to dig reverb tails out of recordings, did that affect your mic choices? Like, how many mics did you choose and what distances did you set them at? Also, did that experience influence your mic placement in terms of where you're pointing them? Like, of course, you're going to point a mic or two at the actual explosion event, but were you also pointing them away from the explosion, like at the distant hills or reflective surfaces in the surrounding environment?
Yes, that's a great question, especially because when I go record this type of thing, I tend to do it alone most of the time, or at least even if I'm accompanied by a friend that happens to be a recordist, I prefer not to use their content just for the sake of making sure that I can create what I need to independently and I can make sort of my own mistakes, if that makes sense. So for this library, what I thought I should do from the get-go, recording all of these explosions and transients and propane cannons and whatnot, would be to have a lot of portable recorders. So normally I think I've seen people tend to have, say, something like a couple of MixPre 10-2s or something like that, and then they would connect everything to cables that are maybe 100 meters, 200 meters, and scatter microphones around the location. In my case, that would have been hard to do because I often had to travel to locations like the top of a mountain where you don't really want to get there with a 16, 100 meter long cables or 50 meter long cables due to how heavy they are, how cumbersome it is to transport the whole thing. So my setup still featured two MixPre 10-2s, which were coupled with mics that would be either all sort of close to the explosion, maybe 150 meters away from the explosion. But most importantly, I had a lot of portable recorders. I had like two Sony D100s that would always sort of be 200 meters away from the explosion, but in opposite directions to really get clear tails, or as clean as possible. At least my sort of safety tails would come from there. Then I would have a Tascam recorder just kind of placed at, I would say, pretty random places just to see if it would capture anything interesting. Similarly, a Roland RO5 in the proximities of the explosion, so maybe 50 meters away or so, because I had never noticed it kind of really losing it on in terms of a representation of the sound and distortion. So that recorder surprised me very positively during these experiments. Then I had an Olympus recorder, Amaranth's recorder, an F3. I had a really large number of recorders on their own, but ultimately when it comes to microphones, I would say that the core of the library still comes from what is ultimately the core of most of my libraries, which is MKH 8040s and 8050 for center. Both of these are quite crisp sounding, they don't mind transients at all, and they come with a smiley hue applied to them in the sense that they feel quite crisp and they can take a lot. So they work really well in the context of explosions. Of course, I still use the Sanken CO100 because it's one of my favorite mics, and if kept at a decent distance from the explosion, could give interesting results when slowed down. Of course, the high frequencies of an explosion will not travel that much and will not last that long. And also, I guess, having an Omni mic in the context of reflections may, from time to time, make things a little bit muddy. So I had to use it sparingly when it came to mixing it in the context of everything else. Then I had micro Uzis, which I think I mostly used almost attached to the explosives because I kind of indicated them in my setup as the expendables. You know, they're fairly cheap, but they do an amazing job. So I tend to kind of spice them up around the setup a little bit closer to the explosion than the 8040s because the price is a bit different, and really like they behave very well. And then I had a bit of a maybe stranger choice for explosions, but a KMR 821i, which is really good on the mids and kind of maybe can help me remember a little bit more of how things were supposed to be when I get back home and I forget about the original sound, because again, the 8040s and 8050 and the sound, can they all skew towards high and kind of crisp?
Yeah.
But that can also mean losing perspective over how beefy and, you know, pleasant in the mids maybe something could be. Of course, you don't really listen to the explosion in the location without hearing protection unless you are something like 400 meters away. So in any case, of course, this is all based on, you know, the perception you have of the event. So it's a little bit of a strange topic in general, because especially you perceive it so much more through vibration through your chest, etc., when you're there. And then there were other mics like the CMPA Avisoft, which are very, very ultrasonically rich. The DPA 4061, which is one of those super high SPL mics that you can pretty much attach to, say, like a gun or a cannon in this case, and get some interesting results. And so on and so forth. I had a couple of vintage mics, but really I used those just to see if I could get something strange. And sometimes it happened, sometimes it didn't. But yeah, a lot of mics, all with different purposes. And then ultimately when it came to getting home and making choices, that was kind of a nightmare at the beginning because I did not understand what role each mic needed to have. But now in hindsight, it's a little bit clearer to me. Though of course it costed some time where I would edit something not to use it. But again, I think it's a mistake that needs to be made so that then a choice can be made rather than something happens without it being deliberate.
Yeah, that's so true. And isn't it better to have too many choices than not enough? I mean, in this situation, at least.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I think you could argue that a really, really strong sound designer would have such a vision that you would already know everything from the beginning, right? But any time that you know everything from the beginning, you're probably executing rather than researching. And in this case, I wasn't exactly sure what I was after until halfway through making this library. So this reminds me of a talk from Mick Gordon on The Music for Doom, where he says something along the lines of needing to be a little bit either brave or courageous when it comes to trying to find a different process, right? And
yeah,
for me, it's sort of about that, about the idea that if I don't put myself through these choices, creative choices that need to happen, then it means that I'm probably taking a road that has already been taken or that I have already taken. And the whole point for me of making libraries still to this day is to kind of think of them like Pokemons and master the different type of elements and whatnot in the domain. So if I was to approach this the same way that I would approach an animal library or something else, then I think I would be depriving myself from the opportunity of growing along the way. So yeah, I agree. It's definitely something that one needs to sort of think about, or at least I like to think about.
Yeah, I mean, it's good to go in with a plan, right? But I think creativity is a journey, right? There's an exploration aspect to creating something that's truly unique, right? You have to be open to that process of exploring new paths. Or, you know, like you said, otherwise you just might end up creating something that's been done before because there's that comfortable groove of familiarity.
Yeah. An example that comes to mind for this type of thing is, like I said, the 8040s and 8050, they're really my main mics. So especially for the explosions, going back home, I would mostly listen to those first to be like, okay, what was it like to be there? And I've done the same thing for recording falling trees, but the results were completely different, meaning that since they skew towards the highs, if you, like me, pointed them at the cracking point of a tree falling, then you'd get home and you would hear a celery break kind of sound. But in your head, you thought, no, but hold on, this was huge.
Right.
And then you listen back to the recording on your phone with all of its, compression and whatever else, and it sounds really big. It sounds bigger on your phone without, you know, downloading the sound to your speakers or anything, then it sounds on your speakers listening to the 8040s that you've come to love. And that's because, again, like the way that they work in the transients, they catch the highs a lot and they catch them real quick. And so you have all of these mega transients in the highs, but it really takes a lot of, again, excavation to kind of find the body and all of those things. And in those cases, for example, I was really glad to have brought more mics that I don't generally use and have placed them in ways that I don't generally rely on, just to get a bit more of the event itself. Like, it's very strange how much the environmental reflections of something like a tree falling can do in the interest of selling that sound as a tree falling.
Right. Let's listen to one of the tree falling sounds that you put together for Cataclysm.
I'm fairly confident at this point that if you were to remove all reflections from something like a, you know, very clear falling tree type of sound, a lot of people would struggle to understand what that was, because you've never heard a tree falling in isolation, in complete isolation. It's more likely that you have heard an explosion in space, if that makes sense. So it's a very jarring realization.
Right, yeah.
The explosion in space is, again, like a reference to some science fiction stuff, but yeah, you get my point. It's very hard to completely remove the reflections from something like a tree falling, and inadvertently I sort of did it, and it did not deliver on what I was expecting, so I had to bring that back later on. And yeah, I learned from my first session, and luckily I was able to have another two or three after the first. So
yeah, because environmental sounds, they don't happen in a vacuum. The tree branches swish through the air, and maybe they hit other branches or leaves on other trees, and then the bits of bark are falling to the ground. I mean, there's so many environment reactions that you might not even be aware of, but that kind of helped to paint that sonic picture of the event.
Exactly, yeah. It's, again, to use another reference, I feel like I'm quoting people more so than expressing my own thoughts, but Mark Mangini said something along the lines of recorded sounds are immediately more relatable because of how they behave in the space, or at least they come from a real space with real reflection, and, you know, the thing happened. So if you take something that has been recorded like that and apply it even to a science fiction element, like, you know, something that visually is very unnatural, then the listener will think, okay, I can buy that.
Yeah.
And similarly, I think you can make the mistake of recording something with real microphones and it's a real sound, but if you get the perspective wrong enough, or you get a little bit too crazy with mic placement or whatever else, then you may end up with a result that somehow doesn't feel like the thing. And I think that happens a lot when you start to record, and maybe you overdo proximity but don't compensate in post. So you have the detail, but actually you start to lose the body, and all of a sudden it's almost like seeing something through a microscope, but you don't know what you're looking at. Maybe you're looking at the cells of the skin of a hand, but you don't know that there's a hand, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's how I feel when listening back to the raw content of some of the sessions that I ultimately didn't use, where the highs were so predominant that you would just lose the context of what are these details even from.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. I mean, you're too focused on it and you need to back up, right? And give a picture of the space around the object, or like a wider sonic view of the event, to help your brain sort of make sense of what it's hearing.
Yeah, exactly. And I think with explosions, editing and all of the propane cannon stuff as well, I've tried to kind of have the initial transient 1 centimeter from you in terms of perception, and then on the bloom of the explosion, move you away to like 50 meters from it, and then move you again on the tail to something like, you know, 200 meters away from it, 300 meters away, so that you're sort of having your cake and eating it too, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You normally want to focus on one of these things, but I wanted everything to be in the foreground, if that makes sense, at the right time.
So Mattia, you've recorded so many interesting sounds for this collection. Which ones stand out for you as surprising or surprisingly challenging? Like, what are some of your favorites in this collection?
Yes, I think one of the things that I liked recording the most was probably this metal vase holder that I had previously mentioned, just because it's in my patio. It was very easy to record. I took my time with it and I failed a couple of times, and then I embedded different microphones and I tried recording it in a bit of a different way, and finally I got what I wanted out of it, which was this very strange rattly kind of element that was much bigger than real life. And that I liked for the simplicity, because I think it was one of the last things that I recorded, and I needed simplicity after all of the complications of setting up the explosives recordings.
Let's take a listen to a couple examples of that metal vase holder in Cataclysm.
Going back to maybe something like the explosives recordings, we had this company in Sweden. They do revivals, I guess you'd call them. They dress up in suits of armor, and they sort of act as if they were in the Middle Ages for that day or that given time. And we recorded with them 10 shots of 1 kilogram of black powder. So that's 10 kilograms of black powder just burnt in a day. And the cannon that they were using at some point pretty much broke the supporting wood plank just because of the sheer power that it had. So that was nice in its own way, both because of how strange it was to be in this context. Also, we had a bit of a barbecue at the end of the day, so it was kind of, everybody was having a blast. They were having a blast because they were doing what they love, and we were doing what we love. So it's just kind of, it's interesting. That's really when things align in the best possible way. The contributors are having a blast as well, but they don't need to scream about it. You know, it's contained joy.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, I don't necessarily want to mention it a second time, but I did ultimately love organizing, or better, running the session at Carrara Marble Caves, just because it was so much preparation that seeing it all finally come together, it was very satisfying to just be able to be in the car, being kind of escorted around these paths in the broken marble, and being able to be in that location in complete silence and hearing these immense sounds taking their time to die off over the course of 10, 15 seconds. It was just, it was one of those experiences where, because you are a sound person and you are just not speaking when the event is happening, it's very humbling to stay there and take it all in and just witness it, you know?
Yeah. Were these active marble quarries that they like shut down for you so you could record in peace and quiet?
These are still active, and that's one of the reasons for which it was possible in the first place to have explosives there. Because for most locations like these, you'd need to get a permission to have explosions happening, because of how unusual that would be in an area such as that, an area with mountains and such.
Yeah.
But until not too long ago, to do excavation processes like these for the marble, you would use explosives. This is no longer the case, if I understand correctly, for the majority of this area, but the permits are still valid. So that ended up being a good workaround for the issue of finding a way to do this in the first place. And then when it came to the when, although these are active sites, they're not active during the weekend. So we had a plan A on a Saturday and a plan B on a Sunday, and we managed to make it work like that. Also, for all of the recording sessions that I organized for explosives, we had two dates and we always used the plan B date, which felt so sketchy considering that if things fell apart on the second date, it would mean going anyway with rain and sort of recording whatever, just because pyrotechnics would need to come the day prior, so they would need to be paid. The location had been locked, so in terms of logistics, for everyone except the sound person, everything would be going down regardless of weather. So I got very lucky there. I got a bit unlucky, I guess, that every plan A failed, but I got very lucky that every plan B succeeded.
Yeah, you do all this planning and you get all those permits and it completely falls through. I mean, that'd be heartbreaking, you know, or at the very least frustrating.
Yeah, it would have been, yeah.
So let's switch to the design sections of the library. In the trailer, there's this shot of your display showing your processing chain and this lovely array of cool plugins. So any words of wisdom to share on using plugins to create sounds? Like, how can you be the most productive with this method? And also, what are some of the pitfalls?
I guess starting from the pitfalls, just because as I mentioned earlier, this library, well, the idea behind it is for it to sort of be a very applicable collection of sounds, which means I didn't want the sounds to feel like the plugins. I didn't want the plugins to almost say anything more than what the raw content was already saying. Then, of course, for the design section and the synthesize section, there's a lot more of a margin to play with things. But generally speaking, for the raw section, I used a lot of subtracting EQing, transient designing plugins, very, very mild stuff until I had to kind of bring everything together and maybe enhance it with a couple of plugins like Enforcer or something like that. In the past, for example, I would do the design section with something like S-Layer and maybe use its granular functionality, so to speak, and sometimes I would oversaturate things. The moral of the story is when I listen back to the design sections for some of my old libraries, I feel like I hear the plugins or I hear the tool more so than the raw content. And for this one, both for the raw section, which is, of course, it's almost a granted thought of not wanting to have it too influenced by plugins. But even for the design section and the synthesized section, I tried to steer away from stuff that has too much of a signature. There are plugins that have sort of a signature, but in their own way. Like, for example, I still use a lot of Meldamorph or Morph, because I can combine two sounds that I've recorded and have them affect each other in what I would say is fairly unforeseeable ways. The results are often fascinating, but they're not very repetitive, if that makes sense. So it's hard to find a plugin that will give you refreshing results every time, but that's one that I really like for that type of thing. And then when it comes to the design section, for example, I embraced something that Joe Ford, who helped a lot on the synthesized part of the library, uses. He uses M-Vocoder to kind of shave off some of the harshness of the highs in some of the kind of grittier and a little bit dirtier sounds. I really like that because it kind of helped making the details of the design section feel more abstract and still somehow grounded. Like it was a strange kind of middle ground. And maybe finally, one of the things that I continued using from past experience, but that I really enjoyed using on this one, was a Synaptic Unfilter. Just because even on a sound that doesn't need excavation process, so to speak, so just kind of a sound that doesn't need to be enhanced from a high frequency perspective, it will still affected in very strange ways. And when you slow things down the way that I sometimes do, especially for the design section, using something like Unfilter can be really cool. Ultimately, almost none of these are really kind of chains. Maybe the funnest chain that I can think of was a combination for the synthesized part of the library, a combination of a Transgressor 2, which is a transient designing plugin that gives you the option of bypassing the sustained part of the sound altogether, leaving you with only the transients, so very clicky kind of results. But pairing that with Enforcer means that then you can kind of have the threshold of the sound triggering Enforcer hitting it so often that you'd get a bit of a kind of an interesting rolling kind of sound.
So you shared with us this vacuum cleaner suction sound that I think is a really great example of that. Let's take a listen.
You can modulate the pitch of Enforcer once you have that threshold being hit constantly with very low cooldown.
Awesome.
So that was a very fun way of experimenting with that plugin. Probably one of my favorite chains for this.
You've put so much hard work into this library, and now that it's finally over, it must feel so rewarding to release it. If you could tell the sound community one thing about Cataclysm, what would you want them to know?
Oh man, one thing is not my main area of expertise. I'll try to summarize the best that I can what I think the library is, I guess, because even with the cover art and everything, I hope that someone just by feel will understand what this is about. But again, just to try and maybe give the best description that I can about the library, I wanted it to have the most varied environmental responses in explosions or loud transients, but very far from an IR collection. I wanted it to feel like a collection of actual explosions and loud transients, etc. Then again, when you think about this type of library, hopefully it's something that inspires a sort of like a fantasy feel, not just because of the cover art, but because of the way that sounds have been processed. And yeah, going back to what we were originally talking about with regards to the references for Star Wars and Dune, yes, a lot of this library is made out of real recordings, but the whole idea is that the content was edited and processed with a sort of like a hyper-real fantasy theme in mind rather than full-on realistic. So hopefully sound designers will find a way to place these sounds out of context, completely out of context, yeah, and give them a completely different meaning, which is ultimately, it would ultimately make me so happy because it would come full circle with what the references were at the source, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, Mateo, thank you so much for having a chat about this library.
My pleasure.
Yeah. You know, the sounds are so cool, and your experience of capturing these sounds seems like it was quite an adventure. I mean, who doesn't want to travel to beautiful places and record controlled explosions? So thank you so much for taking this time to share your story with me.
Of course. Thank you. And thank you for having me again and asking all these questions.
My pleasure.
Looking for more audio-related podcasts to listen to? We're part of the Audio Podcast Alliance, featuring a handpicked selection of the very best podcasts about sound. Be sure to hear the latest episodes from our friends in the community at audiopodcast.org. That's it for this episode. Thanks a lot for listening, and take care.